All right, let's do this. The Flashpoint being $76 billion made by Jeff Bezos since the COVID-19 lockdowns have began, and how that's sort of a model and a precedent being set for civilization and society changing rapidly at the hands of the very few, while the most of us have to deal with the consequences. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. When you look at Amazon and what they've been able to do in 20 years, it's really a blessing and a curse. There's no doubt that not only the Democrats benefited from a pandemic, but companies like Amazon, this was one of the best things that happened. And as you said, Jeff Bezos went through a divorce, and his wife, I think, became like the fifth richest person in the world from that divorce, and he's made up most of that money just in the last, since this whole thing started. And, you know, when you look at what Amazon has done since day one, they were a company that from the very beginning wasn't about selling products. That wasn't the goal. The goal was to sell an experience. And they were willing back in the early days to be extremely price competitive. And what's happened over time is because they've created such convenience in the market, the laws of supply and demand have really, that paradigm has almost shifted to the point that consumers typically will look at products and say, hey, I don't want that. And that would drive the price down. And if they did want it, the price would potentially go up. But in today's world with Amazon, what is concerning to me, and this is the curse side, is that the idea of convenience has really changed that paradigm. And I think in most cases, consumers aren't even looking at pricing anymore because it's become so easy to buy online.
Yeah, I think that's like a great or the most interesting precedent that they've set is putting a monopoly not on a market, but on an idea, like the experience, like you said, putting a monopoly on an idea, kind of infiltrating the collective consciousness of the capitalist societies around the world, and then exploiting that to their own gain and kind of just permeating throughout society. And then you look at, you know, that $76 billion since the COVID-19 lockdowns began, which is less than 6 months at this point, but you combine this structure that they've built, and then it kind of becomes a situation where it's almost like the government is assisting the growth and expansion and domination of the market of Amazon by kind of handing them this on a silver platter, because you look at essential versus non-essential, Amazon's going to be essential every single time, no matter what. And people, a lot of them don't really have a choice. And a lot of people have become so accustomed to that convenience and that idea that it just kind of was a self-fulfilling prophecy initiated by this pandemic and this situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, it's funny, you said something interesting, the government's assisting, and then there's no doubt that the government pick winners and losers at the beginning of this pandemic. But the reality is, yes, today the government is assisting companies like Amazon and Walmart, but those companies are so big. And when you think of capitalism, the way that it was intended was never about having companies as large as these companies are. And you think of all the troubles of the big three in Detroit and, you know, the car companies and what really competition did by allowing foreign exports and things like that to come into this country. It really made a better product from those companies that really weren't delivering much, but they were the only three in the market. So what concerns me is that, yes, the government assists today, but at what point is the government really beholden to whatever these companies, these huge companies want? And if you look at, as I was saying earlier, the capitalism and in the early days, the platform of Amazon, and you think of a platform, you think of Twitter and Facebook and these companies that you know, have all these consumers. Well, Amazon's also a platform because they are connected to so many people and they know so many things about people. In the early days, when they were selling this experience, they allowed other merchants, other dot-coms in the world to sell on their platform, which is pretty amazing because it really allowed mom and pop type companies that, you know, specialized in shower curtain rings to sell on Amazon. And they, you know, they could get some notoriety. And the hope was that, you know, if the customer really liked that experience, they could potentially go directly to that merchant. What's happened over time, though, is, again, that paradigm continues to shift. And now that that company, that small merchant that's selling on the platform, is really being pushed out completely. And they're at the mercy of Amazon. So now Amazon's dictating how they're selling. And I look at this kind of funny. The analogy that I use a lot when I talk about this is I think of an hourglass. You know, that thin little neck in the middle of an hourglass. And if you were to lay that hourglass on its side, on one side you have consumers and the other side you have merchants. And typically, as I said, supply and demand, consumers control that. And that's the great thing about capitalism is that you can't get gouged when the consumers can ultimately decide what things are going to buy. But when we look at that hourglass on its side, what we see is that consumers on one side and these merchants on the other, and what's in the middle in that small little neck is Amazon. And they're controlling every aspect of that buying experience. They're dictating how merchants are going to provide products, how quickly they're going to provide it, what prices they're going to charge for that product. And if that merchant doesn't acquiesce, they simply get overrun by something else. Amazon dictates how consumers see what products are there and what merchants are selling. So if that one merchant doesn't acquiesce, as they get at the bottom, there are pages and pages into a product search potentially, and Amazon can put them out of business. And that's why when I look at consumers and this idea of what's happening in this pandemic with convenience, and they control so much, is that consumers, all of us for that matter, don't understand what the price is ultimately down the line.
I think that the precedent being set by that is looking at that hourglass. You know, in the past, that's sort of always how it's worked. There's always been middlemen, the way this whole system functions. There's always middlemen. There's always progenitors of the system that are going to come in between the consumer and the provider of the product. But once you start talking about cutting off control of that bottleneck of the hourglass, as that middle section continues to converge and get tinier and tinier and tinier, you're talking about singular control over it. And economics 101 is supply and demand, and how you mentioned with capitalism, even if it's sort of illusory in the sense that there's so many moving parts and there's always winners and losers, it creates a market that's hospitable to the majority. And now you have a situation where you have this potential to create artificial supply and demand or artificial scarcity, which is also a part of economics 101, but you're talking about on a weekly basis, you could be, just as investors and stuff can manipulate the stock market and pump the stock market, you can create artificial scarcity by just listing a product as sold out, even though you have a warehouse full of millions of pallets of it or whatever, you know, these massive warehouses of all these commodities and all these essentials. And once you relinquish control to one or, you know, a handful of companies, corporate entities, then you're talking about massive societal consequences. And I think we've gotten a little taste of that, i.e. toilet paper, i.e. panic buying. And the idea of, you could even create artificial panic buying, social experimentation, just to see how masses of people respond to it.
When you control that much of the market, and you're so right. Back in February, when the Wuhan virus was moving onto the shores of the U.S. and we had some situations where there were ships out in the Pacific, that cruise ships that had American passengers on them in February, and we were looking at this on the news, and we were asking those passengers to quarantine. But the idea that this pandemic was going to be on our shores was still, you know, a little far fetched. And to your point, I should say in February, at the end of February, you started to see some signs that were becoming concerning. There were some cases in the West Coast. And I had to my family members, I'd sent a text out to all of them, and I said, you know, this isn't a panic text. I don't want people to, you know, to try to draw conclusions, but it wouldn't be a bad idea if you stocked up on some, just some basic goods, enough for 2 weeks. And what I said was, when you see a storm, a hurricane, a snowstorm, or whatever it is, consumers respond to that, and everybody's going to flock to the grocery stores. And I was afraid that this was going to happen. And although I never expected what was to come down the road, it was, you know, something I was thinking about. But, you know, in the end, what's happened through that, and to your point, if only a few companies control supply, they can pretty much do what they want. And consumers, it doesn't take a lot to get to create fear in the market. And the toilet paper is the best example in the world. And all of us ran out, we bought toilet paper, and we bought, what most of us didn't know at the time was, how much do we actually consume in toilet paper? And yet, 6 months later, we're looking at these stacks of toilet paper that we've gathered, collected, and we're starting to get an idea that, why did we go out and do this? But it was one person to another, rumors of short supply and such. And if we're willing to do that for toilet paper, what would we do if it were actually essential goods, things that we need to live on?
Kind of a scary thought there. And that's kind of the whole idea, is that we're relinquishing our sort of our society into the hands of corporations, and which it's easy to look at corporations. They have figureheads like Bezos is, you know, that $76 billion, which is already an unfathomable sum of money. He's the figurehead of Amazon. And if we're relinquishing so much of our ability to live in a normal society to individuals like Jeff Bezos, what is that saying about the direction that we're going, and what kind of society do we want to build out of this? I would like to call it a wake-up call, what the pandemic has taught us, or what we've had to experience from it, as in, you know, life isn't always lemons and cupcakes. And it would be nice to think that we learn from that and we come together and build something better out of it. But what I see happening, and what I think we all are experiencing, is that we don't have a firm grip on the semblance of reality that we've all experienced for generations. You know, we've had ups and downs and many events that kind of remind us of that, but this is unprecedented. And I kind of look at Amazon and that $76 billion, as well as, you know, there's plenty of other corporate examples and billionaires in that mix. But when you talk about the New World Order, which is a 10 years ago, 5 years ago, to just be throwing that term around casually, you'd be scoffed at and laughed at. But now that term is being thrown around in mainstream media articles and in mainline foundation documents. They openly talk about a new world order. And I think what people need to realize is that the new world order, as it stands or as it's been forming, the new world order is not governmental, it's corporate. And just how you said earlier, how Amazon and these corporations are almost operating above the bounds of government, they're outside of governmental realm and governmental control, and then the governments end up being beholden to them. And that's exactly what we see. They're subverting these structures that have been in place that have given us the society that we've, you know, a lot of us have benefited from and enjoyed for all these years. And this is a little kind of a shot in the gut to say, it seems solid, but it could go away. It could all go away.
Think of it this way. So again, those companies, Silicon Valley companies mostly, they influence the world. Their members are from all over the world. So they're larger. I mean, they're the number of people that they touch is larger than pretty much every country in the world. Like, they have so much influence. And when you look at, just take Facebook for an example, to that point of what government is. And you go back to Nazi Germany, and you go back to the Soviet countries, the Soviet blockade, the Eastern countries there. You weren't allowed to say anything if it did not conform to what the government wanted you to say. And that was, you know, people grew up in fear. We're in a situation now where you've got a company like Facebook, as an example, they're starting to control what we hold dear in our country, which is free speech. And now you have a company like Facebook fact checking government officials, which, you know, we'd all look at and say, hey, that's not a bad thing. But what if the fact checking is beneficial? It's politically motivated, as an example. You would start to see situations where these companies now influence how governments run and how long before it's the actual corporation that is the government, in many examples. And when I look at, go back to Amazon for a second. So you think about where they've traveled in 20 years. So they've created this platform where they have consumers. Think about everything they know about consumers just from the shopping experience.
I remember reading an article in some tech, like a tech publication, that it was probably within the last 10 years, probably 2013, 2015 range, where it talked about how Amazon would gather so much data on its consumers, on its customers, that it would basically be, while you're building your shopping cart, it would be preparing those items for delivery, or even anticipating what you were going to add to your shopping cart ahead of time, because it's easier to not ship it and be ready. Yep. And have that massive, streamlined, just algorithmic system.
Yep.
Be functional and just apply it, rather than to wait around and let the customer make the decision, because it almost knows what you're going to do, and it's almost infiltrating your consciousness through
right.
your activity.
It's influencing your needs and wants. And, you know, the greatest generation, the people in their 70s and their 80s now, they didn't have a lot of wants way back when. They had their needs. They were really frugal. That's the way that they were. They went through the war. The next generation, which is the baby boomers, we saw that particular, that generation, a lot more wants. They didn't think as much about spending money. And as we've gone through the other generations, Gen X, millennials, now Gen Z, and things like that, what we're starting to see is, again, that paradigm where, you know, people would save money to buy things, that's now being influenced in the purchase cycle at an Amazon. And as an example, to your point, that you're going through without even really thinking, you've put things in your basket, not because they're a need or a want, it's because somehow it was placed in your subconscious, and all of a sudden you're purchasing this stuff. And that goes back to that convenience thing, which is so concerning. If we're not challenging a merchant, a true merchant, which we would think Amazon is, but as I said earlier, they're not a merchant. They're a platform. They're selling an experience, and they're harvesting data. Consumers are now not making any choices. A lot of those choices are being made for them. And one more point with Juan Bezos, what concerns me the most with, like a Jeff Bezos as an example, it's not just the harvesting of information. They basically can tell so many things just based on the things we purchase. So, you know, just basic, they probably know if we're Christian. They probably know if we're Muslim, not because we fill out a form. It's just based on some of the things that we purchase through them. But take it a step further. Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, one of the most liberal newspapers in the world. So now he controls a narrative, whatever that might be. He controls what people read online. He controls what people read in his newspaper. Not only that, is look at what Amazon's doing from a digital content perspective. They are now basically making movies. So they are choosing what we watch. And if you think about that for a second, how different the world is. When I was growing up, the Russians were always bad. That was, you know, they were an easy villain. What's funny is when you watch movies of today, you see China in a very different light. So the newest generation, the young kids of today, see China in a very different light, because for whatever reason, Hollywood, companies like Amazon, glorify China. China's not the villain. And that's how kids are growing up today. But that's all being controlled by one person. And, you know, again, we think we benefit when we download something on a Saturday night because it's fun. But again, the information that we're sharing, we're providing without even thinking about it, about who we are, is very scary.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And again, it's easy to overlook the influence of, I love that point about Amazon being a streaming service, and not just a streaming service, but now they're in the market of Amazon originals, just like Netflix and all these other platforms. you have, like, to go back to the Facebook offering fact checks, or, you know, you not having a choice, it's going to fact check it for you, Twitter too. The thing about these corporations, these very powerful elite individuals behind them, they like to hide behind this friendly language, like fact checking, when it seems that should be black and white, it shouldn't be political, right? And for example, on Facebook, during this coronavirus pandemic, the fact checker, the chief fact checker for Facebook, Dr. Stephanie Anderson, wrote white papers on Wuhan bioweapons lab coronavirus studies for the last half a decade or so. And they openly said that they're following the WHO guidelines and their WHO narrative, and that's it. And so you have the person who's obviously in a conflict of interest, obviously beholden to one entity, and that's fact check. And so that's 1984 style stuff, where you're talking about, rather than information being black and white, truth or fiction, now they're creating the gray area where it's okay, well, if it's going to be filtered through our platform, then we tell you what's truth and what's fiction. And sure, the stupid argument is always, oh, well, just don't use that platform, or, you know, they're a private corporation, they can do whatever they want. Okay, but when you're dealing with that amount of influence and that amount of engagement on a global scale, you have a responsibility, I feel like, or there should be some social consciousness to where facts are facts and fiction is fiction, and you can't just blur the lines for political purposes or corporate gain or whatever it is. It's the precedent being set there, and then going into the whole, like, Hollywood, pop culture, streaming services, the influence of that and the new generation growing up in this environment, it's just, it's hard to think about.
Yeah, for sure. As I said, it scares me. The pandemic has really opened a window into people, human beings, how easily we've become manipulated. And if you think about it, we were told to do X, and then we were told to do Y, which appeared to be a contradiction to what X was, but we did it because it was for the greater good. And then we found ourselves being judged by others if we weren't doing that. And if you think about America and what made America great, all of that seems to have been tossed out the window when the pandemic hit. What we found, and things that most of us didn't know, that have, you know, people like myself that have been around for a long time, is we were told when we were growing up with history, kings and queens and the terror, the tyranny that some in the world possess. But in the United States, we had democracy and we voted and we made decisions. And, you know, if we didn't like the way things were going, we would simply remove somebody from office. But what we've seen through this whole thing is these arbitrary rules by these power hungry people. And most of us, we just lined up. We didn't challenge it. And it's really scary to think how your way of life, this new world order that's being shaped for us, and we're not participating in it. It's really scary that 330 million people will not challenge the narrative. And somewhere down the road, we may find ourselves in a very different democracy, something that we don't know anything about today. And, you know, ultimately, we're well on our way. 4-6 months ago, we thought the Green New Deal was absolutely crazy. It'll never happen. It could never happen. And now we look at it where we see cities are running on a third of the electricity they used to because nobody's there. Airplanes are barely full anymore. They're not flying the routes that they used to. And people aren't driving as much. And all of that happened in 6 months. What does another 6 months do? Where are we at that point?
And that's exactly it. Because you could all chalk it up to the pandemic, and this is just, you know, society's shocked response and being kind of brought to its knees by the pandemic. But then you look at it as, no matter how you see the seriousness of the situation of a global pandemic, you see, you know, everybody, how we, just like the 330 million people you mentioned, the United States, how easily they go along with it and don't question the narrative and don't challenge it, they're not considering that even if we are trying to get through this together and even if we do need to make some sacrifices, there's people on the other end who are going to exploit it, who are exploiting it. And it's not just about getting rich. That's, we're past that point. This is about a small group of elite individuals who are leveraging power and social control via the mechanisms that we've talked about, the media, marketplaces, you know, capitalism, and information, really. Like, that's the big one, is just the control of information. And you look at what we talked about, what I brought up to you with the Great Reset, which is this forum, this summit being planned by the World Economic Forum, where they're basically openly now saying, which is, wields massive power and influence, basically a private branch of the UN, where they're openly saying we need a global economic reset. And they have all these different spider web of information of what that entails and what that means. But ultimately, it means pretty much what you brought up of what another 6 months would bring and what we've seen, the progression of this system, where you're talking about the end of private property, the end of
the middle class is gone.
The middle class is gone, the end of national identity, the end of pretty much life as we know it. And to take a closer look at what is shaping this, kind of the secret of it all is, or not even the secret, the open secret of how this system works is, you have governments and you have organizations and you have elite individuals, rich people and corporations, but like the World Economic Forum and many organizations like it, they identify themselves as public-private organizations. So they are public, in which case individuals, mostly rich, very powerful individuals, are participating in it. But then it's foundations, universities, organizations, government officials, all participating and going to meetings and summits and basically developing policy, global policy, developing ideas and future plans outside of the realm of actual government, outside of the realm of the true public, the middle class, the lower class. They have no say in it, but they've been developing this plan for years, and now COVID-19 has sort of been the fulcrum to leverage a lot of these policies into effect and also leverage them into the mainstream zeitgeist of conversation, at least. So now they're openly talking about so much of these things that would otherwise be unthinkable.
Right. And it's because you created fear. People would have rebelled for any other reason. But when you institute fear into our society at the levels that they, that what we've been told, what you'll find is that people will break very quickly. And what I would say, which is, you know, that one of the things that concerns me really more than anything, is this idea that the when you look at what people have done since the beginning of this and what we've all been willing to do and really, you know, hold down in our houses, look at the information that's been given to us. Or maybe I should say hasn't been given to us. So in the U.S., we have 160,000 people have died. But yet, when you look at your circle of friends, your family and your circle of friends, most of us, we don't know anybody. So we take that out to the next circle, right? So our friends, their circle, and those friends circle beyond that. So we're all connected through these little circles of families and friends. But not many of us have horror stories of anybody dying, anybody that we wouldn't expect to have died, you know, to die from this. But the narrative continues to be that, you know, these people are dying to the point that you'd think that they're dying on the street, but we don't know anybody. And nobody's challenging that narrative at all. And in the end, if you create so much fear where you don't even have to provide proof of the impact of this at all, you can pretty much do anything you want. And for any other reason in the world, any other thing that came up, if people wanted to create a new world order, which is always people that have wanted to do that, what we learned through this whole thing is that the human being, we want to believe things are good. We want to trust others. We want to trust government. And what we've realized is that that's probably going to be our downfall in the end.
That's absolutely it. Because throughout history and more modern history, really, in terms of the emergence of the New World Order, you have these factions of government and these individuals who wield massive influence and power, where there's been events where, what was it? You never want to let a good crisis go to waste and that's that sort of thing. Where the opportunity to influence a new world order has been there, and it's been popping up in and out of our lives for the last couple decades, especially 9/11 would be a great example. Plan for the New American Century, that was like a whole document before 9/11 happened, and that was Dick Cheney talking about the need for a new Pearl Harbor to completely redefine America's defenses and feed the military-industrial complex. But all that aside, people's want, or people's really just natural instinct to want to trust each other, want to believe, give everything the benefit of the doubt, and think that a lot of these public figures who present themselves positively to us through the media and whatever else, that they have our best interests in mind. And with what's happened in the last 6 months, I think it's pretty clear that most of them don't, or at least most of them don't have enough control over the entire system to make a difference. So what we see happening because of our willingness to capitulate to this system because we want to believe in the better half of it, which is not even a half anymore, it's dwindling before our eyes. Part of that World Economic Forum Great Reset agenda is something that has books written about it by their members called the Fourth Industrial Revolution, which when you look at the details and how they break it down, it's not an industrial revolution, it's a deindustrialization revolution, where pretty much take all the systems that we've built up in the last 50 years, mostly, you know, that have been years, more than that in the works, but that have created the global economy that we've seen in the last 25, 50 years, all these factors, and just tear them down and destroy them and hand it over to the Amazon. Like, okay, private grocery stores, no longer a thing. It's all Amazon. Tech workers, the idea of humans influencing the tech industry, don't need them. The AI and the machine learning and the automation, it'll take care of it from here. So the talking about the need for a fourth industrial revolution, you're telling people that, again, the essential versus non-essential thing,
right?
We're non-essential.
I think that I think one thing we can agree on in this conversation is that when you think about who's benefited since March 1st, we can easily agree that it's not the consumer. The consumer has given up a lot of what made, again, our democracy great, the freedom of choice. That's changed dramatically. And there's no doubt that the winners are people that are seeking power, whether that be government or corporation. And that is never going to be a good thing for the middle class. And that's what concerns me the most.
I agree completely. And I think we covered a lot of important points. And I'm sure we could keep going endlessly into this.
Yes. It's been a great conversation.
But I very much enjoyed it. I appreciate you joining me. And I'm looking forward to the next time. And maybe we can take this in and see where we touched on it and build on it from there and take a look into where this is going a little further.
Yeah, I think let's do a time check in a month and 2 months and see where we are.
This is at least a good good documentation of where our minds were at and what we're experiencing now. And with the way time and the world is changing around us, it'll be real interesting to check back in.
For sure. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Very much enjoyed. Until next time. I just wanted to add a quick follow-up to that conversation. Things did get cut short. We did have to end things a little bit prematurely, but that's the nature of these things. So it goes. We will definitely be doing a part two and a continuation of expressing a lot of these ideas and building upon some of the things we laid out here and really focusing on what the future will bring for us. And just a little bit of background, my guest is going to remain anonymous, but he is somebody who is very well versed in the world of online merchants and digital payment platforms. So I'm very blessed to have him sharing his insight on these topics that we brought forth today. And while I'm at it, I just want to fact check myself. The name of the Facebook fact checker I reference is in fact Dr. Daniel Anderson, who Facebook used to fact check COVID-19 information. She is of the Duke University Graduate School, and she worked on collaborative projects at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, including studies on bat-borne coronaviruses and things of that nature. So that was that conflict of interest that I was referencing before. Just to set the stage for part two a little bit real quick, a term that I feel like I was searching for and couldn't quite place throughout this original conversation was vertical integration. And that is both what Amazon's model of global permeation has been, but it's also the model of global and corporate governance and how that is being used to take hold of society and shape our future into their own agenda. So that being said, this is my first attempt at a podcast. Still working through the process, still figuring things out, but I greatly appreciate you being here. This is the Utopia is a Scam podcast. I'm really looking forward to continuing this, keeping things going, keeping the conversation alive. So thank you so much, and I'll catch you next time.